So let me begin by saying happy International Women's Day. Woohoo! Also known as my wife's birthday. So, oh, nice t-shirt, Deborah. Love it. So there may be a debate in certain circles about whether being born on International Women's Day is better than being born on Pi Day, which is also Albert Einstein's birthday, also happens to be Stephen Curry's birthday. But anyway, these are minor issues to be resolved by a higher, court. We'll refer them to the higher courts. And I am just back from, I don't know how many days to call. I'll call it an 8-day retreat. I got back yesterday. I had my healing round of golf after my retreat. It's an excellent way to come out of retreat because it's just a physical activity that has no mental aspect except the part where you freak out when you hit bad shots. I'm totally unprepared to teach, which actually is not unusual for those of you who know me. No, I prepared a little bit, but I was thinking about describing my retreat, but it's really boring. So I'll just say that it involves meditating for 6 hours a day, and those are hour-long increments. And I was, as I've been talking about, working with the Anapanasati Sutta, which at some point I may take a little side trip into that with you guys when I feel that I have something helpful to say about it. Anapanasati, I will say a little bit about it now. Anapanasati means mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out. And it's considered one of the most important suttas in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition. And it parallels the four foundations of mindfulness. So the elements of the Anapanasati, there are four segments to it that parallel the foundations of mindfulness. And that brings me right up to the edge of like actually really getting into it. I will just say that it both presents a beautiful path and sort of guidelines to working with my foundations of mindfulness and using the breath. And at the same time, for me, it invites a bunch of questions, like what did the Buddha mean by these things? What exactly are we doing when he says such and such a thing? And so that's where the challenge is, and to sort of kind of tread the line between trying to just work with it and flow with it in a meditation and getting stuck with, well, what am I supposed to be doing, is sort of the difficult part. I also wanted to say hello to Eleanor and thank you so much. I'm so happy about your ship. It's lovely. I didn't realize you had joined the Navy, but you know, it's that was very sweet to come home to that. So you've always been very generous. So. This is my new pillow that I use on my lap. It's my lap pillow. It's kind of like having a pet, you know, having a kitten on your lap. Like this, I just have my hands on this and it sort of, it actually, if you're ever having trouble with your shoulders when you're meditating, which happens especially on retreats when you meditate for a long time, it's good to put something in your lap because when your arms are just hanging down for hours and hours, it can put stress on the shoulders. So sometimes I put a Zafu in my lap, but this is my little, that's your meditation tip for the day. We will now progress beyond the introductory segment of the class into the meditation segment. So, beginning your practice, finding your seat. And this is both literal and metaphorical. But finding the way of holding your body that will support you in staying still and being awake and aware, comfortable enough to not be distracted by pain in the body, but not so comfortable that you drift off into a kind of hazy state. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. So beginning by softening the body, having a sense of just letting go through the body. You can relax the jaw. Release the shoulders. Soften the belly. And right away, just seeing what happens when you move into this different way of being, this effort at meditation. Become aware of the energies that are moving through your body, moving through your mind. Feel your breath as well as it moves in your body. These opening moments of a period of meditation can be challenging, they can be freeing. Sometimes we begin our practice and don't even realize we've begun, or the stream of thoughts just continues to flow. It can also be the case that we notice the anxiety, the stress that tends to carry us through our day. Our normal activities can obscure these feelings by staying busy. So when we stop, sometimes we're faced with a kind of discomfort. It's like this energy wants us to keep moving. It can feel a little bit like we're trapped, like we need to push out of here. Classically, this is called the hindrance of restlessness. And our mindfulness practice is to breathe with that feeling, to actually open to it. And really, this applies to whatever feelings are present, especially any strong feelings, is to breathe with them. That is to say, to feel the breath at the same time that we feel the feeling. In this way, we maintain mindfulness in the body. That helps us to stay balanced in the face of any challenging energies. Sometimes the opposite hindrance will arise, the hindrance of sloth and torpor, sleepiness, drowsiness. So here again, we breathe, but here we use the breath as an energizing force, letting it open the body, and raise the posture. We can see that the breath becomes our partner with whatever experience is happening. Commonly, the mind wanders, thoughts consume us, consume our attention. In those moments, we typically lose touch with the breath, with the body, really with any present moment awareness. That, or at those moments, we really don't have control over our meditation, much less our mind. And so it's only when we realize the mind is wandering, that we're lost in thoughts, that we have the opportunity to come back to the present moment. And as soon as we see this is happening, that the thoughts have consumed us, we gently come back. And gently means we come back without judgment. Without a sense of conflict with the mind. A as with sensations, thoughts arise, thoughts pass. There is no right or wrong judgment to be made. We simply come back, settle again into the body, into the breath. Any period of meditation has its own arc, kind of narrative. Sometimes there will be a gradual settling. Sometimes there will be the opposite, a growing agitation. We might be consumed by some worry or problem, or we might feel surprisingly at ease. There is no template. Each period of meditation is an opportunity to simply be with our experience. And yet we aren't passive in that stance, in that being. There is an engagement. The art of meditation is seeing how to be engaged without creating conflict or creating more pressure or stress as we try to make something happen in our meditation. The quality of effort this quality should be guided by wisdom, not by self. Question then is, what is the wise way to work with whatever is arising? So this becomes our guiding principle. to respond to the present moment with wisdom. Well, greetings again. I didn't hear from either Greg or Walt. I take it they showed up, right? They were okay. I know they're not me, you know, we can't expect, you know, but I would be interested to hear anything about their appearances, anything that you recall about what they offered. Anyone? Did you record those, Monica? Or Angela did? I like that's your point. Go, that's over there.
No, I recorded it. He didn't want to have it up, but I can share it to both of you. And I'm trying to think what the topic was. It seems so long ago.
There's a hand up. Right. Holly's telling us. What was it, Holly?
I'm just looking to see what the topic was.
It was about God. The God issue. Go ahead, Holly. Hi.
It was about the God issue.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Cultivating wholesome, appreciating the miracle of life, gratitude for life. Anyway,
nice.
There was a lot of good stuff. I really enjoyed it.
That was Walt.
That was Greg.
That was Greg.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. I like the thing about how you could think of it other than God. because I always have a problem with that. But I like the idea of being the collective wisdom of the universe. Mm.
Yeah. Nice.
It was good.
Good. Thank you. I guess I should do announcements here too. First of all, we have a retreat coming up. May 15th to the 20th. And we'll put a link in for registering for that. I also wanted to mention, some of you may have noticed if you're on the Tricycle, whatever mailing list, that they used an article from one of my articles last week. And it's actually on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and Working with Emotions. Here is a link to it if you're interested in that. It's actually a pretty good article. I was surprised. It's an old one from Inquiring Mind, the magazine that Tricycle is using, like archived articles on their website. So Inquiring Mind was a Bay Area Buddhist magazine that ran for about 25 years or more. Great magazine. I had the honor of editing a couple of issues, one of them on addiction, but this issue was on what's called Demons and Dharma, we called that issue. If you're interested in Inquiring Mind, the website is simply Inquiring Mind. And it was Wes Nisker was one of the editors, and I'm trying to type and talk at the same time. Pretty sure it's .com. And I'm pretty sure that his choice of that title was one of his typical word plays. It's the Inquirer magazine, of course, the tabloid and the supermarket tabloid, and him calling the Buddhist magazine Inquiring Mind. It's just a play on that, I'm sure. Although I never talked to him about that. I should ask him.
The God issue was Inquiring Mind, and Greg mentioned that and read from an article by Wes Misker.
Oh, really?
So people can maybe also find the God issue at Inquiring Mind.
Yeah, I can. I'll give you the They have their website now is just simply, you know, all their old articles, and it's really great. The one that I've been turning people on to, well, I guess I did, this was last time, it's so long ago, the War and Peace issue, right? And I mentioned that that Bhikkhu Bodhi has a piece in there, and I just when watching an email exchange with one of the editors of Inquiring Mind and Tricycle, because I was telling Tricycle they ought to publish this article from Bhikkhu Bodhi, and Barbara Gates says that at the time there's another Buddhist monk, Thanissaro Bhikkhu Thanjaff, who was highly critical of Bhikkhu Bodhi's article, and that there was like a lot of letters to the editor about it and everything. But to me, it's a sensible response. Anyway, we all have our opinions. It's one of the characteristics of that keep us trapped in the illusion, the enchantment of self, just to go off into that was a little theme from my retreat. Okay, let's get down to something a little bit more, focused.
Sorry,
here.
Really quickly.
What?
Sorry, one more announcement that this Friday is Spirit Rock.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Thank you. It's a good reminder.
I think, maybe.
Yeah,
not.
No, that's right. No, it is.
Second.
It is.
Okay.
No, it is, of course.
Sometimes there was one month, I think it was this year, that it wasn't actually the second Friday. So, but no, yeah. I have the link to it, so I'll put it in the chat.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, good. Thank you. And maybe you can put the link in for the retreat too. All right. Enough business. That took up 8 minutes. good to have a clock on your computer, you know. So we recently started to get into my book, Burning Desire, the Dharma God and the Path of Recovery. And so I thought I would pick up there. Still in the introduction to the book, but there's a lot of important things in the introduction, I think, important to the book anyway. And so if you happen to be reading along, I'm on page 4, a section that starts with Bill Wilson. And you know, his sort of claim that, which is really the basis for the whole, at least the certainly the first three steps of the 12 steps, that he was powerless over alcohol, that he needed God to get sober. So I'll read a little bit. Bill Wilson, one of the founders of AA, says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, known as the Big Book, that his recovery depended upon a belief in the power of God. His own efforts, his self-will, hadn't kept him sober, but something, a higher power, he thinks, allowed this transformation to take place. For those of us who struggled for years to control our drinking or drugging, our gambling or sex addiction, to control other people or untenable situations, this might make a certain amount of sense. Whatever our attitude is about God, if we can't manage things, maybe some other power can. The 12 steps tell us exactly what we need to do in relation to God in order to get and stay clean and sober, to heal. We must turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings, and improve our conscious contact with God. In turning our lives over, we are trying to drop the ego-driven striving that characterizes addicts of all kinds. In asking to have our shortcomings removed, we are acknowledging our need to change. In improving our conscious contact, we are seeking to deepen our spirituality and bring serenity to our lives. So just to stop there, because the next section sort of takes another turn, but sort of responds to that. But in turning our lives over, we are trying to drop the ego-driven striving that characterizes addicts of all kinds. I don't know that this is all that step three is doing, but it seems like an essential part of step three. Step three, for those who don't have it immediately memorized, is we made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. So trying to drop the ego-driven striving, which, you know, I just referred to, you know, the problem of opinions, right? And so, you know, ego is kind of at the center of this question and what that means. You know, this is something that'll come up, I'm sure, repeatedly, but the idea of what a self is and the implications of it are really central to the Buddhist project of enlightenment. And it's really about seeing through this idea of self. And it, you know, it addresses the whole kind of realm of suffering that the Buddha talks about. So in the Anapanasati Sutta, here we go, the last section of it, which is the section on wisdom or insight. There are four elements, or each of the four sections, there are four elements, and thus there are 16 steps in the Anapanasati Sutta. There are four elements. The first one is contemplating impermanence. And this is always pointed to as one of the key elements of Buddhism. And so, but impermanence itself is not the important idea, actually. It's the implications of impermanence, the deeper implication. So first of all, so the second step in this last stage of the Anapanasati is becoming disenchanted with the things that we strive, the ways that we strive for happiness. And so this is the same thing that happens to us as addicts, right? We become disenchanted with our addictive behavior, with the substance or the behavior, whatever it is. We start to see that what we thought was something that we could hold on to and thus permanent, something we could sort of capture, be high, or have this love, or whatever the thing is that we were grasping at, we start to see that it's ungraspable. And therefore, that any attempt to grasp it is bound to end in frustration and what's called dukkha. So this second stage is called the second characteristics of reality, of existence. So we're contemplating impermanence, and that seeing impermanence deeply triggers this disenchantment, losing the obsession. And that then, and then in seeing all that, the third step, which is that called cessation, and this is very much coming from Bhikkhu Anālayo, his analysis, but it's reflected in other teachers, but he pins it precisely. Inevitably, this third step is seeing the emptiness of self, or seeing the emptiness, seeing that this idea of living a life focused on a self causes suffering. And that fundamentally, if we try to actually see what this self is, it is construction, because, return to step one, it's impermanent. So if something is impermanent and constantly changing, then it can't have any solid substance. Now, this is the implication of reflecting deeply on impermanence in Buddhism, that we see that this thing that I identify as myself, this story, this body, these feelings, all of them, they're all real. All those things, all those elements are real, but none of them are actually a self. We have to deal with them. We have to learn how to work with them and live with them. You know, we can't just dismiss them and pretend they're not there. But this key element that we think that there is like a me in there is an illusion. So this is really that what takes us up to the breakthrough of enlightenment. So let me go back to the step and what I say about the step. We are trying to drop the ego-driven striving. So this is when we see this, that everything is impermanent, that there is no satisfaction, and that I'm trying to hold on to and satisfy something that doesn't exist, a self that doesn't exist, then, there's freedom, right? Turning it over. So in 12-step parlance, we're turning it over. So that in Buddhist parlance, I would say we are turning it over to the Dharma. This is why I call it Dharma God. We're saying that, instead of aligning my life and my goals and my intention with satisfying self, I am going to try to align myself and align my actions and my intentions with the teachings of the Dharma. And that immediately takes us, of course, to the Eightfold Path and more. And it takes us here to meditation. Because as much as I can describe, there are these three steps, and then you get here, and then there's freedom. It's a big job. Because we are so deeply conditioned. You know, I mean, addiction is a conditioned state, right? And many of us spent decades trapped in it, unable to break out of it. Self is more deeply conditioned than that. Self is something we are conditioned to believe in from the initial points of consciousness, and I should say awareness, not when we come out of the womb exactly, although we are treated as a self. And so we, as soon as we become conscious, like aware of our world, we see ourselves as a self, because we're treated as a self, because everybody is living in that enchantment, under that spell. And so it's very difficult to break this spell. We can understand everything is impermanent. We can understand it leads to suffering. We can understand that it's the self is empty. It's a creation. But the mental realization does not break through, not immediately. And this is why we meditate. I mean, this is, at its heart, you know, we meditate for many reasons, but when you get to the end of the goal, when people are like, well, what's the goal of meditation? The goal of meditation is to see these realities on a on the same kind of level that you saw that you were an addict and you didn't, and you, in that seeing, in the depth of that seeing, you let it go. I mean, that's a miracle, right? People call it a miracle and people talk about it as, well, that's why people sometimes want to believe in God. It's okay. Nothing wrong with believing in God. Well, there can be problems, but I'll put that aside for now. But it's mysterious because our addiction is so powerful, and for it to just break down at a certain point, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. You know, for me, it seemed quick. It was years of trying to dig out of the hole that I was in, but I didn't realize that what was the hole was, you know, made up of drugs and alcohol. I thought the hole was something else, and so I was trying to fill it with something, the wrong thing. Whatever, that's just not a great metaphor, but I think you get what I'm talking about. You know, once I really realized, like, oh, this doesn't work, I stopped, but that was when the work began, right? So that's another point, but this is what happens to people when they have the breakthrough. Oh, hello? Somebody speaking?
I think it was an accident.
Oh, accidents. Accidents happen. So, you know, this is kind of, I think it's a, you know, recovery is very much a kind of metaphor for enlightenment and spiritual awakening. We use that very term. And I think it's a good model. And it helps us to have a sense of the process and the fact that it's a hard thing to control, you know. It's hard to make yourself enlightened, apparently. And it's hard to make yourself sober, right? And so we kind of understand that, like, right, like, especially those who relapsed a lot, you know, and saw, like, I tried and tried, self-will didn't work. So I want to read a little bit more here. So after this statement I make of sort of three things that the 12 steps say we need to do in relation to God, turn it over, ask to remove our shortcomings, improve our conscious contact. I say, this is all very well in theory, but I've been sober long enough to have seen a lot of suffering around the six steps that refer to God. People who are angry with God, people who are confused about God, people who rebel against the very idea of God, people who scoff at it, and sadly, even people who drink and use in response to the demand that they believe. This, to me, is a tragedy. So that's kind of sketching out the reasoning for writing this book. You know, I never had, after I wrote One Breath at a Time, I sort of thought that I had covered God, but people kept kind of coming to me and saying, could you say more about that? And so eventually, you know, I developed a workshop I did at Spirit Rock. I think a day long. And I started to see there was more that I could say about it. You know, the last idea that people drink and use in response to the demand that they believe in God, that to me is really unfortunate. I mean, all the rest of it makes sense to me, but if someone in a meeting comes up and tells you, you can't stay sober if you don't believe in God. There is a middle finger that can be shown to them as a response. There's a reason why they added, as we understood him, to the end of the step. And it's because people coming into the program early on were like, what are you talking about? I can't do that. And there was quickly this realization, I think, that we don't want to create more of a problem by saying you have to have, you know, you have to believe in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior kind of thing, that we're going to like define God. So let's make sure we don't scare people away or push people away by having this step, even though we feel very strongly that this is what needs to happen. But people are what they are, which is that they will tend to, solidify part of their ego, that self thing, that not seeing impermanence thing, will try to like dogmatize. So if the step says you have to believe in God, you have to believe in God, or you're going to drink, you know, and start to, you know, push people around with that. And, to me, the only requirement for not drinking is not drinking, you know, and all the rest of it can follow from that. But, God isn't really involved. Sorry. Now, in terms of sustaining that state, something has to be done. And that's what the steps are trying to get at. You know, and that's what step three is trying to get at, that I'm going to try to get at in this book. So I will cover the last couple paragraphs here because this is important to me too. According to Karen Armstrong in her book, A History of God, there is no one unchanging idea contained in the word God. Instead, the word contains a whole spectrum of meanings. Had the notion of God not had this flexibility, it would not have survived to become one of the great human ideas. I don't know how great it is, but that's what she says. So I will just point out that what she is saying is that the concept of God is impermanent. So just to be clear about that, and therefore we know that God is not God. That is to say, when we say God can change, then we are not talking about ultimate reality. So we're talking about human thoughts, human ideas. So, you know, that's different from God. She says the 12 steps. The next sentence, the next paragraph. The spectrum of meanings creates the possibility that even people who identify as atheists might find a definition of God that satisfies them. Armstrong tells us that atheism has often been a transitional state, that even Christians were considered atheists by pagans at a time when their vision of God was so new and radical. Yeah, you can imagine, might have talked about this last time, when Christianity came along, and I think just monotheism in general, you know, pagans were like praying to the sun and the moon and the ocean or the earth, whatever. And they said, where's your God? And they're like, see our God. What do you mean you can't? What is your God? Well, I can't explain it. It's just God just controls everything. And they're like, you don't believe in God. You're just in a fantasy. Which a lot of people would agree with. But anyway, she asks, is modern atheism a similar denial of a God which is no longer adequate to the problems of our time? And then I continue, so well that God of 1930s America might not be adequate to the needs of a 21st century addict, the persistent problems of addiction may still require finding a power greater than ourselves to gain and sustain recovery. The Dharma can be that power. Yeah, there's more I could say about this, but we're running out of time, and somebody has put in a large quote from what? The 11-step reading. Oh, wow. Well, if you want to read that, you probably want to save the chat. You can save the chat by going to the, at least in my version of Zoom, there's like a three dots beside the place where you enter a chat, and you click on save chat, should open that menu. So otherwise it might be, since it's going to disappear after the class ends. So I will note that it is 11 o'clock. And so officially I'm going to say that this ends. So if people are, you know, choose to leave or need to leave, please do. And I will hang out for a bit of time, as Greg calls it, in the parking lot. Michelle, hi, please speak.
I don't think you saw my question. I was just curious.
I did not.
I put in the chat, AA put out this pamphlet, The God Word, pretty recently. It's about 12 different AA's experience, strength, and hope on navigating this. And I was just curious your thoughts, if you'd seen it or had any comments. So
that was, I have not seen it.
I put the link later.
Yeah, I clicked on it so I can read it later. I'll look at it. Thank you for pointing that out. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I can't say that I follow AA's, you know, things these much these days. Mm-hmm. You know, which is not meant to be, there's no meaning to that other than my bandwidth, you know. And primary focuses, but thank you. That's great. I know. Certainly, you know, the 12-step world is evolving, and I'm not very involved in it these days as I was for decades, because that's again sort of not where my life is. But because here I am, but. But I mean, it's a tricky thing. We know it's like with Buddhism. It's like, are you going to rewrite the Four Noble Truths? You know, like, wait, no. So I understand people wanting to hang on to the early texts and not change them. At the same time, we have to acknowledge that we need other ways of understanding them. So, Sherry, hi.
I just keeps running through my head turning over to the Dharma, the teachings of the Dharma, seems like such an intellectual process, as opposed to accepting the mystery of the not knowing. Sort of, I just got all confused in my head.
Yeah. So, I don't say anything more. Yeah, I mean, that's what this book is about: is what would it mean? What would it mean to turn your will and your life over to the Dharma? That's what, as we get into this book, that's what it is. But briefly, to me, what it means is, because the Eightfold Path particularly is very instructive in terms of how to live,
right?
It's got very clear moral precepts. It's got ways of viewing the world, of understanding, interpreting our experience. So, I mean, this is very critical because, you know, for instance, I can have a thought, I'm a jerk, right? And in that moment, if I am not, let's say I don't know anything about the Dharma or mindfulness, I just have that thought and I feel crappy. And I'm in a bad mood, and you know, that there I go off in the story. if I've turned my will and my life over to the Dharma, then first and foremost, I'm trying to be mindful, and I'm trying to be mindful of my thoughts. And so that's not intellectual, right? That's very engaged and real. And in that moment, I go, wow, that's interesting that I have that thought. That's, how do I want to respond to that? And so then I apply maybe loving kindness, or I apply investigation. Oh, where is that coming from? And so completely different, right? And so this has a huge shift in my experience. So so what I'm trying to do is align my thinking. And this is very much kind of what the steps are trying to say too. Align my thinking with the thinking of the Dharma rather than the thinking of my ego. My ego is always going to be like, am I good? Am I bad? Am I, do people like me? Do they hate me? Am I going to make a lot of money? Am I going to, whatever, you know, all about me, right? And the Dharma is always pointing away from that. And so it always starts with mindfulness, because in order to engage in this process of changing my relationship to my life, to my experience, I have to be, first of all, be awake and aware. And then I have these other tools, loving kindness, insight, morality, I sure would like that car and the door is unlocked, why don't I just get in and drive away? Besides, I might get arrested. It's like, there's a precept saying, don't do that. So it provides this whole framework for living. So that's what I mean by turning it over. And I hope that in the coming weeks, it'll become more apparent. Jim, hi.
Hey, Kevin. Nice to see you.
You too.
First off, I wanted to say in our Buddhist 12-step group, we are reading Burning Desire right now.
Oh.
And everybody's loving it, really getting a lot out of it. And so just, again, thank you for writing this book. It's so helpful to people who do struggle with the word God. And I would like to suggest an edit for your next version of let me know what you think. So this line where you say in asking to have our shortcomings removed, we are acknowledging our need to change. So,
make it the need to change.
No, I would say our need to be changed.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I think we get stuck in this idea of like, I have to change myself. Right. And I can't really do that. I can change my behavior. You know, sometimes I can change my behavior, but change is this kind of mysterious process.
Yeah.
And I think it involves, you know, what I call a higher power, which is what the Dharma, whatever it is, you know, suddenly I recognize I've been changed.
Yeah.
You know, like suddenly I don't want to do that anymore. Or suddenly I like something that I like a person I didn't like before, or a resentment has been removed from me that I was trying to remove myself for years, you know? So there is this higher power that's, you know, mm-hmm. And when I think it's up to me to change myself, I think I just keep like the suffering cycle in place.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you. You know, just that question, how do we change, is a persistent one for me. Because I always resist turning God into, as I think Sherry said, into a mystery which for me feels like just throwing up my hands and going, well, whatever, somehow it happens. Like, because I'm always afraid that's going to be like abdicating responsibility, but also that for me, there has to be some logic to it. There, more specifically in Buddhist terms, there has to be some karmic process. And for me to be changed, there has to be some karmic process that I am engaged in. And this is like, right, that one of the prime conundrums, you know, that we're faced with in Buddhism. But I don't know. It's, I know I have a piece in my workbook. I have an exercise about change, but I want to address this. I think I have something about this in step 6 or step 7 in this book. So we'll get to it, but point taken, there will not be any edits to this book. I can assure you that. Hay House, who published it, is not very interested in this book, and you've got to get a lot more people out there to buy it before they're going to pay attention to it. It's a poorly selling book.
I wanted to Herb Kagan. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a 12-step teacher. One of his sayings is, it's not done by us, but it's not done without us.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah,
I love that. That paradox, right?
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's about aligning, doing the things that I'm capable of doing in terms of changing my thoughts, words, and deeds, and then letting go of the results, you know. And sometimes they lead where I'd like them to, and sometimes they don't. They lead somewhere, though. I mean, we could also say we're always changing by definition. And so the question really is, in what way are we changing? And so there's no God. The God is involved in change in the sense that impermanence is an aspect of God, in the terms of a Dharma God. Now I am getting too deep, but let me move on to some other folks, because this is exactly why I was afraid about getting into this book, and why at some point I may just abandon it, because it's Mike.
Yeah, hi Kevin. Good to see you back, and great meeting. So you said something earlier that I've been thinking about the idea of self being deeply ingrained, and especially, you know, ever since, like you said, the birth of awareness. And you compared it to our addiction to drugs.
Right.
And, you know, I was thinking more about this, and this addiction to self, I mean, we talk about it a lot in Buddhism, but I haven't really thought about the connection between the two. And I mean, I wonder what, I guess you could make this next step, which is we're addicted to this concept of ourself.
Right.
And that's, when you think of it in those terms, trying to break that addiction is, like you were saying, the whole point of meditation and Buddhism. That's pretty powerful stuff. Thanks.
Yeah. yep. That's you got there, Mike. There at the 2009 Buddhist Recovery Network conference in LA, Santikaro Bhikkhu, actually wasn't a bhikkhu anymore, Santikaro, gave a talk whose title was something like addiction to self. And it was essentially identifying the fundamental or primary addiction of humans is the addiction to self. I don't know if there's a record of that anywhere, but if you're interested, I would suggest you begin by looking at the Buddhist Recovery Network website, which has some, I believe, record of that conference. Because, that's kind of the Buddhist take on addiction. It's less like at least a contemporary Buddhist take on addiction.
I've always thought Buddhism was like a recovery program for regular people.
Yeah.
That just kind of explicitly states it. We're all addicted to self, and this is the program to deal with it.
Yeah. And we turn our will and our lives over to the power of the Dharma to become free of that addiction. So that's what the path is. So Jared et al.
Hey, it's Megan.
Hey, Megan. Hi.
Hi. Nice to see you. Nice to see everyone here.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while. Where are you guys?
We're in Maui.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's too bad you couldn't be in a nice place.
Yeah. So I was listening to everything you were talking about, and I had this mini struggle right in my meditation. And kind of being here in Maui, it's the first time I've had off in years, three years plus. You know, so I really have this attachment to it being peaceful. You know? And
good luck.
And you know, life has just been so chaotic the last few years for everyone and right now. And yeah, so it's just the attachment to it being a particular way, the control.
Right.
How to surrender that control of it is what it is, you know, or like this attachment, I really need a break. I really need a vacation. And then having these expectations, and then here comes in negative thoughts about myself. And it's just, yeah.
Well, I mean, your partner's an addict, and no offense, Jared. Nice to see you, Jared. And, you know, often people who choose addicts as partners have control issues. It is well noted in Al-Anon. So not surprising. I'm just poking fun at you, but it's painful, Megan, you know, to realize that we don't have control. And then this is, again, this whole question of step three. It doesn't mean that I give up trying to, you know, take care of my life or to have a vacation or whatever. But it does mean that I have to hold all that very lightly, you know, that I really take, this is just another moment in time. I mean, vacations are dukkha too. And that's, you know, that's hard to accept, because in our minds, it's like, okay, I mean, of course, Maui, or anybody who's not in Maui right now, is like, yeah, that our minds go there. And in our mind, it's perfect. But anytime we step out of our mind and into the reality of our bodies and the human experience, it's imperfect.
Yeah.
And so our practice, this is where mindfulness and loving kindness are so important, that our practice is, right now it's like this, I'm breathing with this. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant. I wish it were other than this. It's okay that it's not other than this. I can be happy even when things are not exactly the way I want them to be. And if I look around, it's really beautiful and lovely. And maybe I can remind myself, you know. So yeah, that's our work, right? It's our moment by moment, breath by breath work to accept and enjoy and appreciate what is here and let go of the need for it to be other.
Yeah.
And besides, nobody wants to hear people whining about being in Maui. You know?
Well, it's an ongoing thread in my life of control of like,
there you go.
This is not the way I want it to be. How do I flow with this
instead of
becoming like this nasty, mean, moody person?
So, you know, and I think there's, you know, the reflection of, you know, what makes me think that the world should be the way I want it to be, you know? And again, that doesn't mean I shouldn't engage and try to make it pleasant and, you know, and all that, but it's the expectation that creates the suffering. It's not the actual circumstance that creates the suffering. It's the expectation. Yeah. That's why mindfulness is so important. Like, oh, I come back to my body. I come back and I realize, oh, well, this isn't exactly what I wanted with my mind, but what it is okay. You know? So maybe I can let go.
Thank you.
All right. It's really nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Take care. Don't drink or use no matter what.
Can I add one thing
real quick? Yes, go ahead, Jared.
When I contemplate the concepts of like impermanence, you know, and emptiness, like I'm 10 months into my clean time and my abstinence.
Yay.
But the you know, sometimes the darkness and depression will come in. And when I contemplate these like things of like impermanence and things where I'll start to go into that kind of like dark,
yeah,
you know, place with it. And I need to remind myself to like, you know, to be responsible and to like take care of myself and consider not being like selfish or reckless, you know, and just careless and kind of, you know, kind of disappearing and so
you bring up a really important point, Jared. Thank you. It's, we have to be careful in terms of reflecting on certain topics, Dharma topics, because just as you say, like if you reflect a lot on impermanence, but you're in a really difficult place, it can become triggering, negatively triggering. And so if you notice that happening, let it go and like focus on something more helpful, like forgiveness or loving kindness or appreciation of the palm trees, you know, just there was this famous, because the Buddha teaches like go to the charnel ground and watch the dead bodies decompose, you know, and then you'll let go. And early on, apparently a bunch of monks committed suicide after that, because they were doing that so much that they got, just as you said, like into this despair and so that was why the Buddha taught Anapanasati, because Anapanasati points more toward joy and comfort, you know, and so we definitely have to be careful that we don't sort of use the Dharma teachings as a way to create more suffering for ourselves. And as you've said, they can, and I've fallen into that myself at times. I mean, I do a daily reflection on impermanence, on death. And sometimes it's like, oh, okay, I don't, sometimes I kind of just touch up like, okay, good. Yep. I could do it ritually rather than really trying to embrace it, because I feel like, oh, the mood I'm in right now, that's not helping me. Like, so just, don't let the Dharma be used as a cudgel to beat yourself up. Use it constructively.
Okay. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah. And enjoy.
Thank you.
Monica?
Hi there. First of all, I hope you don't abandon the book. I was really excited about you starting this one.
Don't be attached now.
I'm not attached.
No clinging.
No clinging. But I had an interesting experience a few years ago. One of my friends started to really have a problem with the God issue. And I started to be very concerned about, you know, that you just can't, you know, I was one of those people for a while that said, you can't do the program if you don't have a higher power and da, da, da. And because I've been following you for quite some time, I gifted to him a one breath at a time and a burning desire.
Mm.
And then I changed. It was super funny. I heard the call. I came into this sangha, and then I've started evolving. And sometimes I'm confused, but I'm just trying to sit with it. And also I was chairing in a treatment center, and I've told people maybe before, but there were a lot of young people, and they all had problems. It made them freeze up. It turned them off. And I started to understand that it's not a slam dunk anymore, then I also realized that I had been evolving all this time, you know, so it's just a comment.
Yes. Our beliefs in God are impermanent. I have a reflection on that in my workbook. Step two. Anyway.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And I'm doing the workbook with a sponsor.
There's a reflection saying, like, to review your spiritual evolution, like from your childhood, and sort of see how your beliefs have changed over time, so that you can help yourself in this moment to not be attached to the belief that you have right now. Because you realize, oh, well, this might change too. So maybe I'm not right. Or maybe I don't need to be stuck in it or caught in it, trapped in it, especially if it's a negative one. Okay, for our last guest today, Brian, hello. Are you new to us?
I am new, yeah. I've attended a few times. I am a huge fan of your books. I recommend One Breath at a Time to everyone else in recovery. I'm like, read this book. This makes so much sense. It's an outline to live a clean life. It's great. And I just read Burning Desire recently. But my question is about self-esteem. If there is no self and the self is an illusion, how is self-esteem viewed, and does the Buddha say anything about that topic?
Definitely have not seen anything where the Buddha talked about self-esteem. It's a very modern idea, you know. Mm-hmm. And it is something that I explore, the question of, like, sort of how the Buddha thought about how we feel about ourselves. And it seems that it wasn't much of a, it sort of wasn't the way people even thought in that era. You know, that their ideas about self were different. They were more metaphysical, but there wasn't this sort of individuality that we have now. So self-esteem, you know, first of all, what sort of comes up for me is that Diana Winston, who's a great Dharma teacher and friend of mine, she had a talk, I don't know where it is, but it's probably on Dharma Seed, about the distinction between self-compassion and self-esteem. And saying that sort of self-esteem is this like prop, trying to prop yourself up. And it does go to the, something that I've addressed about the Buddha's ideas about self or self-love, that there isn't this idea of like value that we place on ourselves, which is kind of self-esteem, right? Like I'm worth it, right? Saying that that I have some value. The suggestion that if I have value, that, well, maybe I don't have value, you know, that this question of value is not really in the framework of Buddhism around self, that there's an assumption that we care for ourselves, that we love ourselves, that it doesn't make sense to not love ourselves. But that I think is the problem with self-esteem, is that it depends upon a kind of grading system, I think. Maybe I don't understand it. Well, I'll shift gears a little bit. So, because I'm thinking about the sort of everybody gets a trophy thing in the like kids soccer sort of thing, and the idea that that helps them with their self-esteem. And what my understanding is that the way that's understood now is that it doesn't help. That self-esteem or it is founded in our own behavior, right? That again, it kind of goes to worth and value, but I mean, you don't feel good about yourself just because somebody says, oh, you're good. You know, you feel good about yourself because you are good, if that makes sense. Like, you know, your behavior earns that for yourself, right? And but it seems that the idea of self is the problem of self-esteem for people is about self-judgment, but not based really on any reasonable or fair measurement, but based on thoughts and feelings about ourselves. I'm an idiot. I'm fat. I'm stupid. You know, that are just creations of the mind, right? They aren't, you know, people, no matter, and people will keep saying, but you're a good person. Look, you did this, you did that. No, I'm really in it. You don't know me. And I equate a lot of this with mood. That is, when we feel bad, if we're in a bad mood, then because we think there's a self, I think if I feel bad, then I am bad. And so therefore, I degrade myself in my own mind and think of myself as a bad person, in which there's a certain logic to this, right? It's an unfortunate and unhealthy logic, but the experience is like, I'm miserable. So I must be miserable because I'm bad. And that's where I think the whole problem of self-esteem really coalesces around our feelings. And so it then becomes a question of detaching the thoughts from the feelings, which is a critical part of our mindfulness practice. And it's actually the article that I put in earlier from Tricycle, which I will put in again, if I can find it. Where is it? Oh, here it is. This is actually a direct way of working with this challenge of separating thoughts and feelings. So if you're interested, click on that link and read that later. Because this is what I think it really comes down to. Self-esteem isn't really about, am I a worthy person or not? It's about the feeling that I am not a worthy person. And so that's where the work, we have to do the work, is around the feelings and the relationship then, and seeing that, okay, I can have that feeling, I can feel bad, but I don't have to use that as a way to build a narrative about how I'm not worthy and I'm not okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I kind of look at it like these negative thoughts or whatever are coming about, and just look at them like other thoughts, like they're thoughts that come about naturally and we need to detach from them.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's helpful. And I'll definitely read the articles. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that question. We have really gone beyond the normal time frame, but thank you all for coming. And well, 17 people stayed hanging around. Well, I guess 16, because I'm probably counted in that list. In any case, thank you all for showing up and for taking care of yourselves, and pray for Ukraine. Send love.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
We might start sending money to Ukraine, by the way. I've got someone over there that I'm trying to help out potentially. So I will let you know if we need your help. All right.
Did you hear about people who are reserving Airbnbs in Ukraine?
No.
Paying for Airbnbs in Ukraine and not using them.
Oh, good idea.
To send money directly. Yeah.
That's a really good idea. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Jim.
Bye.
Okay.
Good to have you back.
Thanks, guys.